lost it again, and a good one. And on it down, a wonderful save by Schmeichel.
Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Me, Matt Beadle, here with the voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
The day has come.
It has, yes, Richard. It has come.
The day has come. I feel like we've been... Is threatening the word? We've been threatening to do this for quite some time. In fact, that's quite an aggressive word. Although maybe that's apt for the person we're going to speak to.
There you go, mate. There you go. Unbelievable. It just happened. Yeah, it just happened. Almost like you rehearsed that, mate, which you absolutely didn't. So, yeah, I feel like we've been building up to this moment. I also feel like we've definitely peaked. Where do we go from here? Where do we go?
It's that sad moment that you know that there's only one way we can go.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Unless we do a part two, a part three, a part four, which we could have actually done quite easily, couldn't we? I think we've already spoken to the great man himself. That's coming up in just a moment. But yeah, just an all-round solid chat with a solid guy.
Yeah, well, we made a real point in this podcast to try and be a little bit different in terms of what we talk about, haven't we? Because I think it's one of them where it can be really tempting, and we had a good chat before about being really tempting to ask him about certain moments, certain saves, etc., etc., which we've done to an extent. But I think, again, being the Goalkeepers Union podcast, we want to try and get inside the mind of Peter Schmeichel. In fact, we haven't even said his name yet. By the way, in fairness, I'm guessing if you've gone to listen to this on whatever your podcast platform is, you've probably seen Interview with Peter Schmeichel. So maybe there isn't so much of a surprise in that. But no, we just wanted to make a real point of being a little bit different in terms of questions. And actually, a lot of the answers gave fascinated me. You know, we talk a bit about prep for games, feeling nervous for games, how he's dealt with that, how he overcame that. You know, things that I had no idea about. No idea at all, and really interesting answers, some interesting strategies that he talks about as well. Yeah, really fascinating interview.
It is also worth noting that during the conversation, at times, you might hear a little clinking, a little clanking here and there. I think he was just getting up, strolling around his house, making a cup of coffee for himself, as you would, as he offered us these pearls of goalkeeping wisdom, but that's absolutely fine. You're Peter Schmeichel. Not a problem. You can do what you like as far as I'm concerned. Not a problem whatsoever. Okay, shall we get on with it?
Let's do it.
This week's guest is a goalkeeper whose name is now synonymous with the wonderful position we love to talk about. According to one understudy, he was the goalkeeping equivalent of Pelé, Maradona, Cruyff, Ronaldo or Messi. Another said his presence, belief and agility was incomparable. And another quite simply stated he was the best goalkeeper in the world. He's recently revealed his life story in his new book, One, My Autobiography. Peter Schmeichel, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, we're really good. Really good. Really excited about this, actually. We've had many guests on previously, but I think I could talk for Matt as well, and certainly a lot of the guys that will be listening in, where there are so many goalkeepers listening in now that are still playing professional part-time, some that are retired, that when you talk of that sort of golden era, you know, your name comes up a lot. So I've got no doubt we'll have many listening in at the moment. Very excited to hear what you've got to say. But look, we always kick things off in the same fashion, which is to ask our quick fire questions, simple questions. I kind of feel like I know a couple of the answers here, but we'll fire away anyway. First one is goalkeeping gloves. Which gloves did you wear? I think we all know the brand, but what was your favorite pair of goalkeeping gloves you ever had?
I was wearing Roche gloves. I had a pair when I was, I was in Bromby, I can't remember which year, so probably late 80s. I had a pair that I really, really liked, and I had it ever since, but I can't for the life of me tell what model it was.
Fair enough. I bet there's someone out there that will know. I've got no doubt someone listening in will know the exact model.
Honestly, I don't think they were anything specific. I just liked them the way they were.
Great stuff. Well, the second question is, what favourite kit? Now, I'm actually quite intrigued to know, of all the kits you've had, and of course you've had a few famous ones over the year, what's been your favourite goalkeeping jersey?
The favourite, that's an easy one. That was the one I played the European Champions League, the European Championship final in for Denmark, the Harlequin shirt. I really, really like that.
Yeah, do you know what? I've got to give credit to Matt. Matt nailed that. He said it's 100% going to be that kit. So yeah.
Beautiful. Beautiful, Tom.
It
beautiful.
Was a great kit.
It was. I really also like the Champions League one, the green one. Sort of, I really like that. I thought that was a great design, but that was a whole kit. Was specifically just talking about the shirt, because that's what it was back then.
Yeah.
Just a shirt. You didn't have a full kit.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that. And it would be, you'd obviously have like so many goalkeepers, just random colour shorts and random socks that made no sense compared to the top. Those were the days. The last question is most memorable save. Now, we always make the point here that it's not the one that maybe everybody talks about. And you've obviously had many saves that people will talk about, but maybe the one that was quite special to you, and it might have been in training, it might have been on a Tuesday night when no one saw it. But is there a save that sticks in your mind that was memorable to you personally?
Yeah, it was not in training. It was not on a Tuesday. Oh, it might have been on a Tuesday night, actually. Quarterfinal against Inter at Old Trafford in 1999. Header from Zamorano in close, and I came from the other side of the goal. It was a cross. He came running in. He was, I think he was about, yeah, he might have been inside he was just inside from the penalty spot, just there. And I spread myself and I saved it with my left arm. And that for me, for a lot of reasons, I think it looks really great the way it's been filmed, but the importance of it was if they'd scored there, it would have been a different result and we might not have gone through.
Well, do you know, I was actually, funnily enough, I was at that game. And I remember, in fact, we're going to be talking about, I was at that game. So I used to be a season ticket holder back in the day. My dad used to bring me up to Manchester and went to, what was it, Porto away, Monaco away, Barcelona away. So he used to, do you know what? This is really bad. I probably shouldn't say this. He used to take me out of school on a Tuesday lunchtime. We'd get a flight over to wherever it was. And then I'd return to school on the Thursday lunchtime as if nothing had happened. And I was only about 12 years old at the time. But no, I do remember the Inter Milan. In fact, we're going to talk later about that particular season and a few of the games in particular and the big, big saves you made at crucial moments. Because again, I really want to get into your mind in regards to that, what it felt like playing in some of those games. But look, to kick things off, how have the last couple of weeks been? Because you've obviously released your book. It's been a bit of a tour from what it looks like. You've been here, there and everywhere. How's it been since releasing the book?
Yeah, it's been hard work for sure, but it's been very rewarding. I haven't really been out and about for quite a long time due to, you know, a variety of different reasons. But COVID was one of them, of course. And it's been really nice to be out and, you know, hooking up with fans and talking to people, talking about the book. The book is not a football book. It's very much about me and my life, where I came from. Probably, you know, some of the same questions that you're going to ask me today. You know, why could you do what you did? And a lot of looking back, soul searching in a way, you know, made big changes in my life when I was around 50. My father passed away. He plays a really, really big part of my current understanding of myself. So there's a lot of football in it, of course, but there's also a lot of very, very personal stuff, which has been interesting to share with people. So it's been a tough tour, if you like. I've been here, there and everywhere in the shortest possible time. So I've done most of it now. So I'm just having a couple of days not doing very much and enjoying that even more.
A couple of days not doing very much, and here we roll. Sorry, we've interrupted your piece. Sorry, Peter.
I said not doing very much. Yes, you know, in that there is a little bit of doing.
So this whole process for you then, talking about what is in the book, as you've just stated there, because I remember your book from, I think, when you left Manchester United back in 1999. It was the autobiography. It was a Schmeichel, the autobiography. This is obviously one, my autobiography. They are obviously quite different books, the pair of them. Have you found it a cathartic process going through and sharing all of those thoughts and sharing your difficult times?
Yeah, I'm a bit sad about this first book. And I'll not go into any details, but When you put your life out there in an autobiography, for me, I never do anything half. If I do anything half, I do it the right way, so that, you know, I'm not hiding. There's a theme in my book, and I follow the theme wherever it takes me. I'm not say, oh, I cannot say that because I don't want people to know this. Or, you know, everything that I came across is in the book. So it's not edited in any way. But my first book, I never saw it until it was printed. You know, I never had a chance to edit anything. And that was due to, you know, the guy who was a very nice guy writing it. He had some issues and disappeared. And eventually deadline was coming close, and it was kind of shambolic. And I'm not making excuses because I couldn't even have stopped it. I mean, legally, I couldn't have done anything. I was really shocked when I saw the book. And of course, you know, most of what's in the book, I kind of talked about that. But one thing is when you say something and it goes through somebody else's pen and the understanding of what I said, it might have been misunderstood. You know what I'm saying? So there's a few things in there that I was, you know, very, very sad about. And I didn't want to do a book. I didn't want to do anything. But in that time, between that book and between up until now, a lot of things happened in my life. I mean, I'm not going to go into details about what's in this new book. But my father, who never brought his past into our lives, kind of slowly started to open up, but only a little bit. Very difficult to get more out of him, but he opened up a little bit, and there are certain things that shocked me and surprised me, but also it gave some kind of meaning to myself. And of course, we went through a period of 2.5 years where he was ill and in and out of hospital and passed away. Made me think about, you know, him and his life and me. So I was sort of in the process of, you know, trying to figure out a lot of stuff. And then lockdown came. And lockdown was an opportunity because at that time, I wasn't doing not so much. I was doing absolutely nothing, you know. And I think most people were doing absolutely nothing. Football stopped. You know, you came back. You can do stuff on Zoom, but you weren't really involved or anything. But the first period, did nothing. So I spoke to Jonathan, who we've already spoken about this, Jonathan Northcroft, who writes for the Sunday Times. And I spoke to him and I said, are you doing anything? He's not. Okay, should we do the book now? And that was a way I wanted to do it anyway. I wanted to have all the time in the world. I wanted to go into every little detail. I wanted to twist and turn every word so it gave the correct meaning. I wanted it to be absolutely inch perfect and written in the most beautiful way it could. And because we had so much time, I think the result is very, very good. I'm very proud of the book. I have to say, Jonathan's just done an absolutely fantastic job. And if there are anyone out there listening who I think we're thinking about doing an autobiography once, well, Jonathan is your man. There you go.
That's quite the advert for Jonathan, certainly. Well, look, just on that note, and I've got no doubt that given the guys and girls that are listening to this podcast, my guess is that a lot will have bought your book already, given that it is very much goalkeeper, ex-goalkeepers, current goalkeepers, young goalkeepers. And I'm sure if they haven't, no doubt they will very soon. Because I've got, again, there's certain books that I'll always recommend to young goalkeepers when they ask me, because so many will ask me, you know, as to which direction they should go in and how can they improve what they do. Well, one of the most obvious things I'll always say to anybody is to find people that have walked in the footsteps you want to walk, you know, and if they've already done it and they've done it to a high level and you can learn a little bit more about that person, there's going to be something you're going to be able to take from that.
I agree. I do the same thing in my areas of interest. I do the same thing. I look at people, see how they do it, and just work. Until I get as close as I can to that. Of course, I always look at the top people. See, you know, because to get to the top, any line of business, any line of these of life, it's so difficult. So there must be something in there that person has done that is something that I, for instance, haven't thought about. And so by looking at the top people. So aiming for the highest point. You might aim for the sky, but only reach the top of the tree. But then you are reaching further up than you would anyway. So it's a good thing to always look at top people. How are they doing? No, you can look at everyone, but the top people, they have ideas that other people don't have, you know? So.
Well, that leads us on really nicely, actually. What's the quote? I think I had this on my wall when I was a kid. Was aim for the moon and miss, you become one of the stars. And it is, I really do like that idea that you, as you say, you follow or find ideas from those that are doing it at the very top of their game. So that brings us on nicely in terms of you, the goalkeeper. I mentioned that so many listening in will want to know and want to be able to get inside your mind when it came to a game day, for instance. Yeah. You know, so many goalkeepers that are preparing for games, some getting incredibly nervous, some not necessarily preparing in the right way. One thing I wanted to ask you about, and me and Matt both spoke about this before the pod, was that you played with a certain style. You know, I'd use the word aggressive. Yeah. In fact, assertive I would use. You were very assertive. You demanded the very best from those around you, the very best from yourself, and you really played with that kind of passion. I would argue now there's not that many goalkeepers that seem to play or seem to be in that state when they play. And again, there isn't necessarily a right or wrong. Everybody has their own style. They've got their own way in which they can get them into the best state possible. But for you, was that something quite conscious that you would go out there and you would feel that energy, feel that passion when you went into every game?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think one of the reasons you don't see it anymore, it's a generational thing. You don't see that in people anymore. Mm. You see idiots on a Sunday night, Saturday nights in, you know, outside the pubs, having had one too many. That's not the same though. I was very deliberate in my way of being. But I played with people, strong-minded people, a collective of a group of people that was picked as much for their strong mentality as for their footballing skills. And we all had our different ways of being and dealing with you know, pressure and whatever is in there. But I was very deliberate. I actually go into detail about that in the book, about how I wanted to be inside the head of anyone I played against. And I wanted to be as annoying as I could be and arrogant and, you know, just keeping or trying to keep an upper hand against everybody. Because there is a chapter in there where I talk about goalkeeping and how I see the job, you know, my thinking about, because goalkeeping is, it's very much a reaction or reactional position. It's not a proactive. You can't really prepare anything in a game because you have to react to something that happens. So when you sort of think about that sentiment, it's a position where you have no control, and control is the most important thing. What control can you get? Where can you get in control of a situation? You can't really, but you can get in control of yourself. You can tell yourself that you are this, and then try to become that to your opponents. So I tried very, very much to get into the heads of players that I played against. I also very deliberately never paid any attention to them. So I would not really think about who I played against. I wouldn't be thinking, oh, we're playing this team today and that's got this guy up front. And that is, of course, with very, very few exceptions. So, for instance, first time I played against Wimbledon and John Fashanu, not that he was, you know, this incredible player, but he was a bully on the pitch. And because I had a really good start to my career at Old Trafford, and I was coming for everything, all crosses and stuff like that. I was basically doing precisely the same as I was doing in Denmark. So flying in and out, they hadn't seen this. You know, they hadn't had a goalkeeper like that at United. So my teammates started to think, say, just wait till you meet Fash. And I didn't know who this Fash was. So I have to say, when we played that game, he was a little bit inside of my head. And I did make a mistake because of that. So I took a lesson off it, thinking if he could get inside of my head and I made a mistake because of that, well, if I turn that around, I can then, you know, if I get inside of, you know, my opponent's heads, then they don't make mistakes that cost goal, but they could miss chances or opportunities or be focused on something different. So I was very deliberate with that.
It's interesting. We've actually just spoke about that very subject on this week's podcast that Matt and I did. When we've seen, in fact, it's a Liverpool-Man United game, and talking about when certain players coming up against others, and you just wonder at times whether that does get into players' heads. The other bit that you said there, which, again, fascinated me and fascinates goalkeepers, is that you're right, it's a reactionary position. You have no control. And actually, the more that I've studied, probably post-career, if anything, is that I used to get quite nervous for games. And I think a lot of it was based on that, the fact that you had such little control. You could feel fantastic in the morning, great night's sleep, great breakfast, great preparation, and go out and lose 5-0 and have a bad game. And similarly, you could not sleep. I remember one game I played in particular where I barely slept the whole night and went out and actually did okay the next day. So it was that not knowing and the fact that you had such little control. I know personally, I struggle with that a bit. Now, you never, ever gave off the impression that you were ever nervous. You always looked so powerful, so confident. Was that for you natural, or was that something that you had to work on?
That's another story from the book that I can sort of talk about. I was very, very nervous when I was a younger player. Just, you know, still senior player, but when I was younger, 18, 19 years of age, the team that I played for played their home game on Sundays at 7 o'clock. And back then, I was semi-pro, so I also worked during the week. So from getting off work on Friday and all the way to Sunday night, I was so nervous. Couldn't think about anything else in the game. And of course, it kind of ruined my weekends. And it disappeared. The moment I went out for my warm-ups, it was gone. Then I wasn't nervous. And in the games, I wasn't nervous at all. And then I went from that club to Bromby. And Bromby had qualified for what is the Champions League today, the quarterfinals. So back then we played calendar years. So I would start in Bromby on January 1st. And in the autumn, they'd qualify for the next stages of the old, you know, Champions Cup, I think it was Cup, or European Cup. So my first game as a Bromby player, and actually a full-time professional footballer as well, was against Porto in the quarterfinals away. Never played in front of more than, I think, 6,000 people. But normally we play in front of 2,500. I've never played against an international team, and I was an absolute wreck. I mean, I was so nervous. And then I won't go into details, but the stories in the book about how I felt on the coach and stuff like that, the destructive thinking that I allowed myself to sort of do. But the old stadium in Porto, the dressing rooms were behind, I think, the goals, but you had to go via a tunnel underneath because it's a running track. So from the dressing rooms, quite a bit of way. I mean, about maybe 30 yards this tunnel was. And I'm going out for my warm-up. I hadn't been on the pitch like my teammates. They were up there. I just got changed and got ready for my warm-up. And I am so nervous. I can hardly tie my shoelaces. So halfway through the tunnel, I stopped. And I'm thinking, what the hell, Pete? This is what you've been dreaming about every night. This is what you wanted all your life. You're here now. You're playing on the big stage. There'll be people in the seats. That's what you wanted, man. Why are you so nervous? You have to go out there and enjoy it. So I made a decision, which is so weird. I decided never to be nervous again. Never. I went out, my warm-up. I played a good game. Unfortunately, we lost 1-0. We took Porto, who eventually won the European Cup. In the final against Bayern Munich, which we lost 1-0 away and drew 1-1 at home. So I was, you know, introduced to the big stage at the highest level of European football. And I was dealing with it. It was fine. And I was never, ever in my life nervous again. because I made that decision to enjoy it instead. And I cannot explain the mechanisms or process behind it because I don't know. I just decided that that's how it's going to be. And I'm actually quite happy about that because when you then end up at a place like Manchester United that progressively become more and more successful, and the targets are, you know, winning more and more, but winning higher levels. So you start with, you know, winning the championship, then you have to win everything in your country, but then you have to move into Europe. And it's not that easy to make that transition. And it took us quite a few years to do that. But you all the time have to be better and progress. And once you do that, and once you progress to the end of all the tournaments, so for instance, in 99, you know, we obviously win all three, but we had replays in the FA Cup. We're in the semifinals, quarterfinals of the Champions League, and when you look at the fixture list, how compressed it was in those last sort of 14 weeks or whatever it was. If you were nervous, you know, if you allow yourself to be nervous in that, you couldn't have played. You would have died. I mean, then that wouldn't have been, you know, a possibility to play all those games, because every single one of them would have been played like it was a cup final. So you can't be nervous. And so I'm happy I was able to do that.
See, that also takes a specific type of mindset though, doesn't it? I know you said that you can't explain the mechanisms behind that, and you're almost happy that you don't really know how that happens. But say if I walked out of here today and said, right, I'm no longer going to be scared of heights. I'm no longer going to be scared of spiders or snakes or anything like that. And then my mind could just make that work. And I'm not scared of heights anymore, so it's fine. Doesn't matter. I can walk to the top of that cliff. It's absolutely no problem for me. So how did it work for you that you were suddenly like, do you know what? I'm not going to be nervous anymore. And then click, it's done. No longer nervous for the rest of your career.
I think, if I'm honest, I think it's just part of my talent. It's part of the group that I was part of, talent as well. And I think in scouting us and looking at us over a period of time, that would have been something they've looked for. How strong is that person or player's mentality? Because we need that. We need very, very strong players. We only have to look at the current situation at Manchester United. How do you think these guys are dealing with that? How do you think Ole is dealing with what you know, the pressure that is mounting in him now? You know, you need to be so strong mentally that it kind of really is inhuman. But you know, everyone I played with, that means players who actually came onto the pitch, they were like that. There's a lot of players there who came, never really got to the pitch, then disappeared again because they didn't have that. They might have been better footballers. They might have been more obvious talents, but they were not strong enough. And that's I think, when you get to the, you know, the very, very top end of performance, sport, arts, whatever, I think that's something you're just born with that and you can't explain it.
Well, you know, it's so interesting that you say that. It's going to move us on nicely to 99 and talk about a couple of those games and how you felt in those moments. I mean, you've already touched on it there and obviously in the book as well. But I think, like, one of the things for me now, and I've only learned this sort of later in my career, and I wish it's such a simple thing to learn, but I wish I'd learned it younger, which is that taking offense is a choice. You know, like, and certainly in the world we're in now, where it's very easy to decide to take offense to this, that, the other. But I'm watching that United team of many, many years. I'm watching, you know, you, Bruce, Pallister, whoever it might be, screaming at each other, but knowing that it's not personal, knowing that this is just a case of a load of men that are desperate to win a football match, desperate to win trophies, and you're all holding yourself to the absolute highest standard you possibly can. Matt and I were talking off air. We both watched the Michael Jordan documentary, which was excellent as well. And there's kind of similarities there as well, where it's you don't care how you do it. You just find a way to win. And you've got that strength of character, strength of mind in order to do that. You know, and that team, certainly then, that 98-99 and previous to that, of course, as well, you seem to have that. Was that very much from, obviously, yourselves as individuals, but also from the manager?
I think it was from everyone. It's kind of, I touched on it just now. I think everyone had been scouted at some point, and the guys who weren't, so, you know, the class of 92 who came through the academy and the youth system, they've been taught, they've been educated that way, and picked, you know, picked out of a group. That group, by the way, was incredible. And the five players that we know about, they were special. Of course they were. But there were more special players in that squad. They just didn't have that, you know, just didn't have that extra strong mentality that you need to have to be part of that environment. So when players came from the outside, they had been, you know, as I say, scouted. I know for a fact that I was watched on, they watched me 13 times over a period of a year. After watching me the first time, Alan Hutchinson, who became my goalkeeping coach, said to Fergie that he should sign me, watching me one time, and they still watched me 12 more times. So you know, nothing was left to coincidences or, so Alex really, really, really wanted to know every little bit of me. And the thing about him then is that he then did know everything about me, which in turn made me appreciate working with him even more. Because he knew when I needed something. I put it that way. He knew when I needed something. And it could be in a time where nobody else in the squad needed that very same thing, but he would provide it for me. And also, you know, things like knowing my family, understanding that I was living in another country, not too far away from home, but still, you know, I still had to fly an hour and a half. And, you know, sometimes I needed to hook up with them and allowing me to do that. So little things like being allowed to stay one day extra after an international break, meaning that I would then fly. So back then it was different. We played only on Wednesday nights. So we would come back Thursday, people will see if they can get fine flights, come back Thursday morning to go straight to training and then train. So, but I would stay and fly out Thursday evening and come to training Friday. And that meant one day in training before our next league game, which could be away from home as well. So that meant, you know, basically just, you know, bringing my suitcase to training and then moving on to the game. And that's not, it's not the best way of preparing for the game, but he knew that I needed that. So he allowed me to do that because he trusted me. And in that trust was that he understood that I was strong enough to deal with this situation. Because it is a situation. It's not a negative situation, but I was strong enough. I he trusted me to be strong mentally, strong enough to prepare myself for the game. And of course that comes from only knowing who you're dealing with. So I talk about that in the book as well, about how Sir Alex is, I don't know, his brilliance very much lies in how he taps into every person. So that's a positive and a negative, because he also gets to know people that he don't want to deal with and just let them go. So but at the end of the day, for him, it was all about producing a team that could win. And I think it's fair to say that he did that.
Yeah, no, he certainly did. You talk about that trust, and I guess that being a good example where you had a bit of time off, wasn't it, in the final season, and came back stronger than ever. And I do want to touch on a couple of those performances in particular, not just to, I suppose, the obvious question, how it felt, big games, etc. I suppose I'm more interested in the idea of, well, we talk a lot about big saves. We do our podcast each week and we'll talk about big saves. And for me, it's something that I've never quite figured out, because it kind of seems like certain goalkeepers have a tendency of making those saves when it really matters. Now, you could talk about it logically and you could say, you know, you prepare as well as you can, physically, technically, tactically, psychologically, etc. And you just give yourself the best chance. But it did just feel, that season in particular, and so often in your career, that when it came to the big moment, you pulled through. Now, I want to know how much for you that was down to just good preparation, being in the right place at the right time, and just happening to make that save. Or how much of that is that little bit extra? That's something special. Maybe that bit that you can't necessarily explain. You know, I mentioned, the game against Arsenal as a great example, Newcastle, even the Champions League, Inter being at that game in particular, where each of these saves, it only takes for one of those not to happen and United don't win the treble. You know, it's as simple as that. Like, for you, how much of that was, I suppose, logical, and how much of it can't necessarily be explained?
What a question that is, by the way.
I'm glad you said it, Peter.
We're getting all spiritual now, Peter.
So the last 14 games of that season was played with 3.8 days between them. Every single one was a cup final. Hmm. There is absolutely no way that you can prepare for each and every one of those games individually. You just have to trust yourself that you are good enough to be where you are, that your teammates are good enough to be where they are, and we as a collective, that we can get through this game with the result that we need. That's our preparation. I know it's a bit shocking and very simplified, but that's our preparation. So what comes in between the games is recuperation, trying to get physically ready for the next game. You play that many games of that magnitude with that importance. You will get knocks. And I mean, Christ, can't tell you how many injuries I played with in that period of you know, different kind. I'll tell you a funny story, by the way. I'm just stepping. I was in Manchester the other day, and I see a hand surgeon there because I have a finger. I really want to have an artificial joint in that finger because it annoys me so much. But it's not good enough. What's on the market is not good enough yet. You don't want to do it. But I also had a little bit of pain in another place on my right hand. And I had an x-ray and scanned, and he said, oh, you've had a fracture there. What? I didn't even know that I'd broken my hand. And I say this because this is the crazy thing about it. When you're in that frame of mind, I'm not saying that that was in this period, by the way, but I have no clue when that was, when I had that fracture. But when you're in that frame of mind, everything goes away. Pain, opposition, importance, just everything goes away. You know you're there to do a job, and you do the job the best you can. So that's sort of a general kind of thinking around it, which I would find that most people would find a little bit weird, because whenever I talk about this, people are shocked at the somehow casual approach to it. But it's not really a casual approach. This is about trusting your ability knowing that the preparation that you've done in your, you know, coming into the team, you know, your education in football, your understanding of all that has already been done, and you're maintaining and progressing. So in terms of when it comes to situations in games, then I play with top quality players in front of me. Absolutely top players, so you can make deals with these guys. So you say, when this kind of situation happens, to give me the best chance, push them that way, show them outside, you know, don't show them inside, don't in this situation, don't spread your legs, or all these kind of things. So they want, as much as I want, they might want to make a deal with me, because they don't want to be exposed. So they don't want to do one thing, but they will want to do that one thing if that's what the goalkeeper wants. And then, of course, I always said, push them wide. Just push them wide, because, you know, to cover your angles, it's quite probably the easiest bit in goalkeeping when it comes to saving chances. So push them wide. Let me deal with the angles then, and don't spread your legs. And so you you get into a system. I had it with everyone I played with, from Bruce Pally and all the way to the end where I played with Jaap Henning and Ronnie. Then, of course, you what you do in these situations is you agree between you that you allow the strikers or the opposition to have a shot at goal. But because I trust them to push them that wide, they trust me to come out and close the corner or close the angles there. And that's I think that is really important, that that kind of understanding happens. So when it doesn't happen, so I always talk about this in pictures. So I see this picture developing, and I know that the longer I played, I've seen that picture more and more. I could kind of predict what was going to happen next. So I could also see that, for instance, Yap's out of place or out of balance. So this will happen. And that means that I can then take up a position. This has all happened by instinct, by the way. I'm not thinking all this. But I can now then get myself into this situation. That gives me a better chance for what's going to happen next. And that is a header or a shot or a volley, whatever. And that is where I think the so-called big saves are coming from.
Just on that as well, I know that Gary Neville, and you alluded to it there, Gary Neville always used to say, or has said since in his punditry, that you would scream at your defenders to get out of the way. You just said it, you know, you'd let the shot come in. You don't often see that now. We see deflected goals so much in the modern game. And that was something you were quite big on, right? You wanted the defenders to almost clear the space because you had more confidence in saving it than they had in blocking it.
Yeah. Depends. Absolutely depends on where the ball is. For me, the worst, absolutely worst shot or chance to face was somebody running directly with the ball towards the goal, right in the middle. You can't read anything out of it. Anything can happen. So there you want your defenders to absolutely challenge and charge in. But once you get in sort of the angle, so if you look at the goal, the width of the goal, once you get outside of it, you can put, you know, just think about drawing two lines up the penalty box. So anything outside of that, get out of the way. Because it is, I have to say, I found it really, I say easy, that's a bit arrogant, but I found it easy to cover angles. I found it easy. It was much better for me to have, you know, a clean shot to deal with than having to wait to see if it was passing or going through the legs or being deflected. Or, for instance, a great example is in the Juventus game away from home. The second goal that Inzaghi scored, it gets a deflection of Yap. I have no chance, absolutely no chance. But if you think about it, you can go back on YouTube and watch it. If it doesn't get a deflection of Yap, it goes straight into my palms. You know, it's an easy save. You know, so you don't want your defenders to take that unnecessary risk of trying to dive in, or I don't know. I liked it that way. And it was interesting once, you know, I get to other clubs and play with other players, maybe just a small level down, if you like. I can say that because I left United as European champion. So basically everyone was just a little level lower than us at the time. How it was difficult for them to understand what I wanted. But we got there and they see the benefits of it because it makes their job so much easier. But then to do that, you then have to deliver. And that's a key here, because they have to trust you. Because if they let somebody go down the side into the angles and I seem to be doing nothing about it, so not challenging, not diving in, and it's a goal, then they will be blamed for not having done enough. So obviously you need to produce that save. You need to stop the ball.
I think a big lesson for, and again, a lot of the younger goalkeepers listening in, is, I suppose, taking ownership, you know, taking ownership of a situation, something like that, building the relationship with those in front of you so that you can, again, you're all working together for the same goal. And actually, there might be preferences. I guess what you're saying makes complete sense. And if that does make sense to the younger goalkeepers out there, I guess have the, you know, the belief, confidence to go and speak to those in front of you and demand that, like you did. Well, look, last couple of questions from me. This has been fascinating. One question I do want to ask is about the evolution of goalkeeping and the way in which goalkeeping's going, just to get your thoughts on maybe parts that you like and if there's anything in particular that you don't like.
I really like how good the goalkeepers have become technically with their feet. I really like the way that the ball has been passed out and the trust that's been put in the goalkeepers with, creating play from the very back. I think that is it's made football more interesting, and it's given more options in the game. I also really hate the way that's been played out from the back, because it's all the time. So I would like, I have this discussion quite often, by the way, but I would like a greater variety of what the goalkeeper's doing when he gets a ball. So a team like Liverpool, for instance, who are so well organized in the pressing with the three guys they have up front, doesn't matter who, what three of the four incredible strikers they have, they are so great at pressing and closing down, and it's all driven by Henderson behind, you know. If you, as I did, you know, I've been in empty stadiums listening in to you know, how this is organized and how it's been driven. If you have players like that, you're playing against players like that, then the variety is what is the greatest weapon against that. Because you, if you pass it out every time, then they know and they can prepare and they can get into position. But if they don't know, that little bit of time you win by that. So when I say don't know, so that means you either, you know, you can just kick it up the other end. There's a purpose for kicking the ball up the other end. You know, you get all your players up the other end, you get them to turn around and so on. Or you play, you know, little things into a halfway line, stuff like that. If you can create more variety in that, then I think the game will be more interesting. But at the moment, coaches want the ball to be played out from the back, and there's only really the top teams who are, you know, playing with variety. Look at Man City, by the way. People say they always played out from the back, but they don't. They don't. They have like 3-4 different ways of playing the ball out, and it's brilliant to watch. And they're defending champions, and it's not a coincidence because they have all this quality. But that's one thing I would, you know, if I could, you know, give a little bit of advice to goalkeepers now, is just think about that. Think about your distribution. Your distribution is 80% of your game today. That's what it is. So you're being judged on your distribution. So when you pass the ball out to your left back and he loses the ball and it's a goal, well, that started with you. And I work as a pundit, and that's where I will pick it up. I said, well, the goalkeeper should have passed the ball out to him. So think about it, read the game and put that variety in. But I think it's brilliant to watch, you know, that I don't think anything has gone off the traditional way of that we, you know, goalkeepers are supposed to perform. I still see that we have, you know, all the quality saving and handling and all that. But that addition with the feet is just developed. And I remember, because it changed the rules. When I came to Manchester United, that was my first season was 1991. I could pick up back passes with my hands. So that got changed. So obviously you had to change your way of playing. And that was a great, great rule change, because it did something very positive for football. And we, of course, had to find ways of dealing with that. And also they changed the second rule. That was a couple of years later. When you caught the ball, back in the day, you could only take 3 steps. Now to speed the game up, we could run with the ball in our hands. I mean, it sounds a bit silly that rule was even there before, but it sped the game up, and it gave someone like me who really liked to throw the ball out, it gave me incredible options of distributing the ball. So, for goalkeepers, take care. Work really, really hard on your distribution, because that is such a big part of a goalkeeper's game today. And take advantage of the rules. They're there. They are there for you to take advantage of as well.
Yeah, that long throw, I certainly remember seeing you do that. It's actually something we were speaking about before, how it's almost creeping back into the game a little bit more. Not that it ever went away, but you feel like it's just starting to come back again. Sam Johnstone with an assist just the other day. I wanted to ask you about the spread, Peter, because I think we have to ask you about that, because that's another thing when you speak about modern techniques now in the game. Now, I'm not saying it's been completely eradicated. Of course it hasn't. But if I think of our formative football fan years, Rich and I were spent watching you produce that spread. Now, it may have occurred somewhere before, who knows, but I just remember at the time seeing you produce that spread. There's one particular game actually that I think of that isn't often talked about. It was a Coca-Cola Cup game, I want to say, is probably the sponsor at the time. It was away at Everton, and you produced that epic spread, you know, wide spider-like stance that you produced. And I remember thinking at the time, what on earth just happened there? I've never seen anything like that before. Now, I know that it essentially came from handball and that's where you got your inspiration, but what is it all about? Just making yourself as big as you possibly can. And also, that's something, in terms of the specifics of that technique, you don't really see it too often in a modern game, not in the way that you did it.
No, it definitely came from handball. When I was a kid, because of where I live, cold in the winter, so hot in the summer, so you could only play football outdoor a little bit more than half of the year. And then you had these cold winters, and we didn't have outdoor facilities to play football outdoor. So we played indoor football and handball. It was the same team, same group of players. You develop things from different sports by instinct, I think, naturally, without even thinking about it, sort of introduces it to the next sport. So handball and football are similar in a way that you play up towards two goals, and you know, you can have quick counter-attacking. And as a goalkeeper in handball, of course, you can use your whole body. You can also use your hands, as you can in football. And that, because it's a quick game, we developed, you know, the counter-attacking from very, very early on. We tried to bring that into football as well. When I say try, that's probably wrong. We just did it. It was something that we just did because we were so used to doing that in handball. And I actually carried on playing handball all the way up till just before I started in Brøndby. So I was about 20 at the time. So that's something that stayed with me. And of course, being a handball goalkeeper, in order to save, give yourself an opportunity to save, you need to trick the guy who's shooting into doing what you want. And that's by, you know, doing different kind of patterns, you know, you spread yourself. And of course, if they jump over the line, the only chance you really have is you jump out and spread yourself as big as you are. And you know, and of course, you have that kind of instinct naturally. You bring it into the next game, which is football. It's something you, with your podcast, you can do some work on that. But just to listen to commentators who haven't got a clue about, for instance, De Gea the other night in Europe, saving with his foot, you know? It's unorthodox, they say. And I'm like, no, it's not unorthodox. It's a save. Doesn't matter how you save. Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how you save the ball. It's... You know, once it comes to that part of goalkeeping, anything you can do to save the ball and be successful is a success, you know? So it's nothing unorthodox. I don't know what orthodox would have been then. What should he get done? You know, when something like that, a ball comes to you that quick, just anything that saves it makes it a great save. Doesn't matter how. And that is something you learn from being a goalkeeper in handball. So I remember this one from Everton because I remember the dressing room afterwards. Everybody looked at me, and I know we can't swear on this podcast, but they were looking at me thinking, what was that? I mean, and I was just laughing. I didn't think about it. It's just, you know, you just try. So I always had this kind of, I always knew what was going to happen next. I don't know if this sounds crazy, but I'm coming out. So, for instance, I save a ball, and I know I'm not catching it. I know that instant, as soon as it hits my, I know that I'm not catching, but I know where the ball's going to go, and therefore, already then, I'm on my way to that point. So I remember this one from Everton. There, I think I'm a little bit out of balance, and it gets up in the air, whatever, something like that. But I know where the ball's going to go, and I'm just chasing it. I know I don't get to it. So basically just trying to get myself as big as I can to stop whatever happens next. And I think that's in that is an instinct that any goalkeeper should have, you know, just keep thinking about the next moment, the next moment, pushing yourself to the next moment, trying to understand when I do this. I mean, everything is, of course, very, very quick. But chasing, chasing, chasing. And what, when you do all that, your opponents, it has an effect on your opponents. They will think twice the next time. And the more you do it, it's like a battle. The more you do something, the more you get superior in something, the less superior your opponents will be. So just you know, keep chasing, keep doing, and it doesn't matter how you do it, but do it.
Do you know what? I think that's a perfect note to bring the podcast to a close. What you were saying,
I was going
to
say, mate, people could see our faces now. We've both got these beaming smiles on our faces just listening. So, have we got another 3 hours, please, to talk about goalkeeping?
Well, no, do you know what? And it is, Peter, you might not know, but that's the exact reason we started this pod several years ago. And it started out just me and Matt doing it as a... just because I think we'd heard a comment or two that had really wound us up, that had gone beyond the poor punditry from ex-outfield players on goalkeeping with so little knowledge or being able to really pick apart the detail as to what had happened. And you just hear the generic nonsense over and over and over. And I think everything you've just said there is absolutely spot on. And the advice you've given, absolutely spot on for young goalkeepers. Look, we always finish with the same question to everyone. We always get a variety of responses, and I'm intrigued to know what your response will be. But the last question we ask is, Peter Schmeichel, what has goalkeeping given you?
It's giving me a great life, a great career, and something, just something that I always wanted to do. It's just been brilliant. Goalkeeping. I say this to every kid, all the kids I meet. So what position are you playing? I play right. Oh, you should be in goal. Goal is the best position. It's the best.
Peter Schmeichel, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
He goes to his right, on his left again, and finds Barlow. Brilliant save from Schmeichel. Cotty goes in. Schmeichel comes again, makes another save. And there's no way past the big blonde giant. Well, the whole of Goodison Park rises to, I think I'm justified in saying, some world-class goalkeeping. First of all, it was Barlow stopped from point-blank range, and then he clawed it away from Cotty, and then used all of his body to get in the way of Stewart. Brecky. Barlow makes a run. Finds Barlow. Good pace for Barlow. Oh, Schmeichel again. There's no way past it. What do you have to do to beat Peter Schmeichel?
So that was Peter Schmeichel. Fair to say that certainly lived up to its billing. So good to talk to him. So good to hear his thoughts. And I'm just happy that when he started diving into his book and referencing other goalkeepers who may wish to write one, you didn't dive in with, well, you know, graduation, life lessons of a footballer and all that.
So tempted. You know me too well.
So glad you refrained.
I know, because it had been that awkward moment where he would have had absolutely no idea what I was talking about. So I thought, best not. Let's keep this very much focused on the great man himself, the great Dane, indeed. But no, I really, really enjoyed it. I mean, there's a few key points for me. In fact, I'm interested to know, what were the key points for you, Matthew?
So the bits that I jotted down as he was talking were... the fact that he never thought about the opposition, bar that story regarding the crazy gang and John Fashanu, the fact that he never thought about the opposition, so effectively didn't really study the opposition, I suppose that meant as well, didn't really look at what he would be coming up against because he had such confidence in himself. And it came across in there, the fact that he decided that he was never going to be nervous again. He just made that decision. And when we pressed him on it, he said, maybe that's just the talent that I have, that I was able to flick that switch without having to go through a process. And I also love the fact that when we spoke about the spread, it always leads back to punditry. And he brought that in himself, which I quite liked.
Yeah, that did. It was a perfect way to finish the pod, I felt. And yeah, you mentioned there a couple of bits for me. The decision not to get nervous is an interesting one because so many... people that we've spoken to seem to have like a similar answer in that it's almost one day it gets to a point where it's enough's enough. Decision made. That is how I'm going to be moving forward. I will never go back to how I am. And the thing is, you think about that logically. Of course, it makes complete sense. The problem, I think, is that
it is so simplistic, but actually it can be. You know, like I remember someone saying to me, and this was actually quite powerful to me, that the difference between being nervous and being excited is very, very closely aligned. You know, are you actually nervous or are you excited? And actually even just changing the word, changing the meaning to what you're feeling is, can that then produce a more positive output? But yeah, I found that fascinating. The fact that the way he was very much by design. As you say, it was, can I get into the heads of those around me, my players as well, but also the opposition. The fact that him and the teammates that he had, I think he just made it really clear that that missing piece, the edge that they had, that winning mentality for all the talent in the world. And I think a lot of us know this, I think intrinsically, that for all the talent that you've got, so much of it comes down to that, your will to win, your will to find a way. You know, spoke about the big saves that he made and making them at the big times. And without him saying it, and I kind of went down a bit of a weird route, I appreciate, when I was asking that question, but he kind of answered it in the way that I thought he would, in that he essentially said he just knew what was going to happen. And that's what I was trying to get to, was how do you explain that? How do you put that into a book, a technical book about goalkeeping? He just knew what was going to happen and he found a way of saving it. Not always technically correct according to the FA manual, but he found a way of keeping the ball out the net, which, as he made his point at the end, does it matter? Does it matter how you keep it out? If you can read what's about to happen and you can find a way of getting the ball out of the net, then surely that's enough.
Two more things before we go. Can we maybe put an end to the reach for the moon and fall for the stars, whatever it is, comment? What's just the cheesiest thing you've ever said, mate? And you've just said it to Peter Schmeichel. I couldn't believe it.
I mean, you've got the quote wrong. It's reach for the moon and you land amongst the stars.
Right, okay.
If you miss. Sorry, I've got it wrong myself there. Reach for the moon. Brilliant. And if you miss, you land amongst them. What a beautiful quote.
I mean, that's the kind of cheesy rom-com Hollywood line, isn't it? You've got so much more in your locker, and that's what you chose to give to Peter Schmeichel. I thought, oh my gosh, his name's going to disappear from the Zoom chat in a minute. Okay. He's going to go.
Okay, all right, fine. Note taken. I'll tell you what, now that you've said that, I guess it's a bit of a setback. And do you know what a setback is?
It paves the way for comebacks.
It's a setup for a comeback, yeah. That's exactly what it is, so...
All right, thanks, mate. and lastly, we did off air, because you forgot to ask him, we did off air want him to clarify whether he touched the ball. In fact, that's wrong, whether he flicked the ball on in that Champions League final against Bayern Munich. And he confirmed that he did not. So
he confirmed that he did touch it, though.
He confirmed that he touched it. But that he flicked it on, two different things.
I mean, we're talking about a definition here. That's what we're you know, it's semantics. Is that the word?
His last touch for Manchester United too. That was his last ever touch for the club.
That's amazing to think that. The last touch was flicking on a header from which they scored. So, yeah, vital.
Great stuff. Okay, hope everybody has enjoyed that podcast. We've got a few more, haven't we, lined up, Richard? So more chats in the offing.
Indeed. We're certainly, like you say, back with a bang. It's only going to get worse from here.
Richard, thank you.
Matthew, thank you.
This has been the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Keepers
away.